Hello, podcast listeners. A quick notice before we get started with today's episode. We are currently fundraising for a new podcast mini-series. It's on the topic of Ovid's poem, The Fasti, and it features Rhiannon Evans and Peter Davis. The campaign will be running until the end of October. It will be exclusive to supporters only, so if you would like to check it out and maybe pledge your support, go to kickstarter.com and search for Ovid's Fasti. Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and today, something a little different. This is Episode CL, Q&AVI. And just to unpack what could surely be, to the uninitiated, a rather confusing bunch of consonants, this is the sixth Q&A that we've had with the audience of Emperors of Rome. And to do something slightly different to celebrate the 150th episode, we held it live via Zoom with an audience from across the world. It featured myself, Associate Professor Rhiannon Evans, Dr. Kaelin Davenport, and special guest ABC journalist Virginia Trioli, who was kind enough to dress up for the occasion and provide us with this lovely intro. Here's Virginia Trioli.
Awe, as Professor Evans has taught me to say, and I'm very delighted to be here to welcome you to this very special Emperors of Rome 150th episode live event. I am not your host this evening. You know who that guy is. I'll formally introduce him to you in a moment. But as Matt said, I'm Virginia Trioli from ABC Radio and ABC TV, and I'm really thrilled that Matt's asked me to introduce this evening and to tell you who'll be joining you, what you'll be doing, and then I'll get out of the way. I've been a huge fan of this wildly successful podcast for many years. I've run and walked the length of the city of Melbourne to this podcast, and I listened to every single one of them. Emperors of Rome started in 2014, and it very quickly became a huge success on Apple Podcasts, I remember in particular, and elsewhere, as well as being one of the most successful podcasts in the country. It very quickly garnered fans from around the world, and from a re-listen that I actually just did during this pandemic, you'll be pleased to hear, I went back and listened to almost every single episode again, which shows you I really do need some recommendations for some new podcasts, I think. From that re-listen, I realised that you started receiving comments and requests and questions from around the world after just a few episodes. So it hit home, and it hit home early. But like all good performances, the success of this podcast rests on the strength of its leads. Your host, Matt Smith, and Professor Rhiannon Evans are the perfect odd couple of the academic world. The charming and not-so-donnish professor and her fast-talking student, I've always imagined, who I suspect cooked up this whole podcast ruse back in the day, possibly as maybe for as a decoy for, I'm imagining, a long delayed and I assume as yet unfinished doctoral thesis or something, maybe some way of, you know, hey, look over here, Professor, why don't we do this podcast together? And she'll forget to keep asking me about, you know, where's the thing? Of course, I imagine Rhiannon would have been wise to that. How could she not be wise to anything at all? But, you know, went along with it, what the heck. And the success you've seen is in the what they do together, the way they are together, and the wonderful way that they bring extraordinary Roman history to life. So tonight, Melbourne time, your questions are being answered by the brilliant gang that has made such good company for you here in Australia and around the world. So let me introduce Associate Professor Rhiannon Evans, who's the Head of Languages and Linguistics at La Trobe University, Dr. Kaelin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University and Humboldt Research Fellow at Goethe University in Frankfurt, Germany, and who has become a regular member of the podcast as well, equally as charming, slightly more donnish in my assessment. And Matt Smith, host and broadcast ballast, he describes himself as, the guy who edits this in between feeding and putting babies to bed and managing the rest of his life. He's a fabulous host as well. Matt, bonum vesperum to you, and over to you.
Ah, muchas gracias. I'm sure there was something more appropriate to say than that. Thank you very much, Virginia. And thanks to everyone for coming and being with us today. There's so many of you, and I'm assuming from so many far-flung places as well. It's great to see you all. But our first question, and Virginia, this is why I'd want you to stick around, because I thought that you might have an answer for this as well. It comes from Julian McKay Dixon, who I believe is in the audience tonight. If we could interview only one emperor, which one would that be? And what is the first question that you'd ask?
Oh.
So I thought that was a good question, which I've just landed on you there, Virginia. But I assume that Rhiannon and Kaylin, you may have given some thought to that. If you could interview, have a chat with maybe a nice soy latte or something with one Roman emperor once you guys are out of lockdown and you have a time machine, who would it be and what would you ask?
I would choose Claudius.
Oh, that was mine. Bugger.
Oh, no. I'm so sorry. Maybe our question will be different. Because I've been a big Claudius aficionado ever since I saw I, Claudius, when I was a teenager. And I'd really like to ask him why he chose to marry Agrippina and then promote Nero above his own son, Britannicus. That's something that's always frustrated me, wanting to know what was in his mind. So that's what I would ask Claudius.
It's difficult, isn't it? So many choices. I think I'd actually like to sit down with Domitian, which is not something many people would say. He's quite a scary emperor. And I'd like to do a little bit of psychoanalysis on him and ask him what his relationship with his brother Titus really was like, and then try to read between the lines, because all the evidence suggests that he would give me an answer which papered over the truth. I would want to look very carefully at the way that he answers, in a way that Virginia is probably used to having to do with her interviewees. Really, this is the ideal question for you, Virginia, because you've interviewed so many people over the years.
I think this is so hilarious, and it clearly means that I feel, and I hope, Matt, I hope you agree, that I've now earned my membership of the Emperors of Rome podcast, because I'll show you my notes. What I planned to say was either Domitian or Caracalla.
Oh, Caracalla.
Yeah, because I really would like to sit down with one of the great monsters of ancient Rome and, exactly as you say, Rhiannon, do a little bit of psychoanalysis, because for me interviewing is all about psychology. And when I'm talking to someone and I'm preparing to interview someone, the preparation is always about where they come from, what drives them, what their insecurities and anxieties are, what the gaps in their life have been that they're desperately trying to fill. And so the psychological starting point is always the one for interviewing. But then I said, but if I, you know, couldn't get to do the absolute monsters, then I'd go for Claudius. So there you go. So I've been listening to you guys too much. You're in my head.
Quite coincidentally, my answer was Domitian as well. So there you go. It's a very crowded Domitian couch. Mostly because for quite a while now, I've been working on writing a work of fiction called Domitian Must Die. And I need more background. That was my answer as well. My other answer, though, was Trajan. And the reason that I would like to interview Trajan, and I will be corrected quite quickly if I'm wrong here, there is no primary source concerning his time as emperor.
Oh, there's no biography.
There's no biography of him. Yeah. We've lost them. So
there's Pliny's Panegyricus. Sorry, yeah.
I just think that would be an interesting gap to fill in.
Then you could write his biography.
Exactly. So for everybody who's watching this at home, the order of proceedings are that we've got a bunch of questions for our Q&A episode, which people submitted earlier, but I would not like to leave out those of you who are at home. So there's a handy Q&A function down the bottom of here. And if you want to put your questions in, which some people are already doing, then Rhiannon or Kaylin might like to select one. And we will ask of you to ask your own questions.
I'd love to answer the one about Agrippa Postumus.
All right, let's go with that then. I'll get Zach. And Zachary Crawford.
Hi. So I'm studying ancient history at the moment. I'm a first year student. Okay. And I'm writing a paper, and it's sort of like a murder mystery. We've got to figure out who killed Agrippa Postumus, and we're comparing a bunch of ancient sources. I am starting that in a few days, but I thought I'd get a bit of a head start on the rest of the students who are writing this and ask it of you. What are the theories around his death? And because we don't quite know who killed him, especially because Augustus made him an heir with Tiberius. So,
yes, it's a fascinating question. And this is Tacitus very famously says that the death of Agrippa Postumus was the the first crime of the new Principate, so the first crime of Tiberius's reign. But lots of academics, well, a considerable number of academics, have actually turned the spotlight onto Augustus himself. Now, it's said that Augustus made a last-minute trip in AD 14 before his death to the island of Planasia, to which Agrippa Postumus had been exiled. And this is because, as you quite rightly say, he was adopted by Augustus along with Tiberius. So Tiberius being Augustus's stepson and Agrippa Postumus being his grandson through Julia and Agrippa. But then in very mysterious circumstances was sent first out from Rome to Sorrentum. He was grounded, and then he was sent into official exile by a decree of the Senate. And this is because he had too violent a temper or was giving in to vices. This is what we're told. And historians have tried to reconstruct lots of theories about, you know, was there a group behind a group of Postumus trying to put him forward as a real rival for Tiberius. But some scholars think that Augustus, although he made this sort of last minute visit in AD 14, did actually order the death, because this would lead to a stable succession for Tiberius. The other culprit is, of course, Tiberius himself, who avowed that he had no knowledge of this and was content to let rumour fly. The other interesting thing is that 2 years later, in AD 16, a former slave of Agrippa Postumus called Clemens claimed to be Agrippa himself, that he'd escaped from Planasia, and he went through Italy, arriving at Ostia, where he was greeted with crowds of people, and then, you know, had lots of senatorial and equestrian supporters as well. Now, Tacitus says that he was a slave, but Jane Bellamore, an Australian historian at the University of Newcastle, has argued that it really was Agrippa Postumus, that he actually did manage to escape there. I'm quite cynical. I think it probably was Tiberius. I follow the Tacitian line, but there are scholars who do think it was Augustus.
That'd be really interesting if the fake one actually was him. I seem to remember there were lots of fake Neros as well after the passing of Nero. Rhiannon, did you see any questions there that take your fancy, or shall I dip into the ones that have been submitted already?
Oh, there's so many. Oh, my goodness. Just scrolling down. Some of them are really quite hard as well. I better take one that we've already had, otherwise I'll just hold things up.
All right, we'll take one from Niobe, who's age 10. She's from Ottawa, Canada. Did Romans keep pets as opposed to work animals? If so, what animals did they keep?
Yeah, they most certainly did keep pets, Niobe, which is a fantastic name, by the way. They had dogs. So you might see very commonly mosaics of dogs, often in doorways, in thresholds, which seems to suggest that they were guard dogs. I don't know whether you regard that as working animals. Greyhounds seem to have been quite popular, or something approximating a greyhound. They might have been slightly different breeds then. We also know that the one of the saddest things that we see in Pompeii, where you might know that we've got the kind of casts, the plaster casts of the people and other animals who were caught in the destruction of Pompeii. And one of them is of a dog who's chained up, still chained, and therefore couldn't get away. Well, I think it's sad as a dog owner. But also other kinds of animals, birds, very popular. So we have poems about sparrows and parrots, and actually kind of mourning the loss of those animals. So we know there was affection for them. Monkeys as well, cats. There are mosaics with cats, although sometimes attacking birds. And fish. Fish were very popular, and fish were kind of a showy pet to have. Actually, I don't even know if you'd think of them as a pet or a kind of showing off that you had lots of money and could afford very extravagant and expensive fish. So if you were exceedingly wealthy, you might have a fish pond in attached to your villa and display fish that were worth like a huge, obscene amounts of money. And there is a story of one particular figure who mourns the death of his fish like they were members of his family. And I think we get that from Pliny the Elder. So there are emotions attached to these animals who are pets, and they most certainly did have close relationships with them, as we do too, and they're keeping them in their households.
Thank you for that. Tiberius had a pet snake. When it died, he took that as a kind of sign that he needed to quickly leave Rome, which he did, and I think probably never came back at that point, maybe.
Snakes are very ominous, so, you know, they're often there as signs of things to come. I didn't really think of it as a pet, but I guess you could call it that, yeah.
Mm.
I've got something that I want to answer. It's very, very easy for me to answer, which is somebody has asked, oh, actually, it's somebody who's here. So Cynthia Wilson asks, would you consider a rewatch series of I, Claudius after Rome? Well, first of all, I'd say that Matt and I are getting through Rome quite slowly. We're not binging on it, are we? And that's just because we don't have much time, but we're enjoying it. It's just taking us a while. So, you know, we might finish it sometime next year, maybe. Then there's a second series too. But there is already a rewatch series of I, Claudius, which was done quite recently. So I wouldn't tread on their toes. It's called I, Podius. They've completed, I think, both series, but certainly the first series. So that's already out there. We don't need to reproduce that. Although it would be great. And maybe we will eventually do something like that.
I think considering we've got another 17 episodes to go, it might take us a while. It'd be like, you know, 2022 is probably optimistic for us wrapping up that podcast sometime. So hopefully we won't be in lockdown by then.
Well, I'm just going to lodge an official complaint about that, because you guys are moving way too slowly on the Rome rewatch.
Yeah.
I'm speaking on behalf of everyone who's tuned in for this one. So get on with it.
The bits that Matt probably takes out are me asking, what happened in the last episode, which is a good sign that we need to speed up, but it's just time. We'll do our best.
Kaelin, have you got a question that you want to grab?
Yes, there's one from Andrew McDonald about which of the ancient literary sources that don't survive.
Andrew, I believe I'm allowing you to talk if that's your question.
That is my question, Matt. Great to talk to you guys. Fantastic. I'm absolutely pumped listening and watching you guys. So, yeah, I was asking about the ancient literary sources. I'm thinking along the lines of Sulla's autobiography, Marius Maximus, who, from memory, Ammianus Marcellinus said everyone's reading in the 4th century CE. And also, I'm trying to remember, didn't Agrippina the Elder also write an autobiography? So which one of those sources, or any others that I haven't mentioned, would you wish that didn't survive, had survived?
Well, it's a great question, first of all. I'm in two minds. There's so many wonderful possibilities. Firstly, you know, the biographies of Marius Maximus would be a must-have. We'd be able to see how much of the historiographer actually relies on Marius Maximus and how much was actually made up, which I think if they turned up would send many historians who have built their careers on working out what Marius Maximus actually says running, screaming for cover. Also, I think you just mentioned at the end, the autobiography of Agrippina would be fantastic.
I agree on that one, I think. For one thing, one of the frustrating things about studying ancient Rome is the lack of sources authored by women. So we have some, but they're few and far between. And, you know, they tend to be more inscriptions and briefer, or maybe a few poems if you're lucky. So it would be so great to have and Matt would like that as well, because at this very moment, he is doing some research on Agrippina so that we can record a podcast on her.
Yeah, I did find a reference to that autobiography. Also, a shout out to Septimius Severus, who wrote his own autobiography, which we don't have as well, which would be really interesting to find and know a bit more about where he's coming from.
Can I add a quick follow-up question to that, to Kaelin and Rhiannon and to Matt? What's the possibility that there still are out there somewhere undiscovered sources in some form or another?
Not great.
I'm a bit more positive. So they recently found in the Austrian National Library in Vienna, in a palimpsest, another, text is written on top of another one. Yeah. They found some fragments, new fragments of the historian Dexippus, who was writing in the 3rd century AD, for which we don't have many contemporary sources, and he was a contemporary. So this is very exciting. They are fragments, but they have come to light. So, and they're using sort of multispectral imaging technology to read them.
And it's also always possible that if they do more excavation at Herculaneum, that the Villa of the Papyri, as it's called, because they found so many papyri there, will generate more texts. A lot of people are disappointed that most of what they've found is, you know, is by someone called Philodemus, who was an Epicurean philosopher. Although one of my old students works on Philodemus, so she's pretty happy with that. Whatever you find is interesting. But who knows, it was probably the villa of Julius Caesar's father-in-law, Piso, and he would have had a very full library, I'm sure, not just Epicurean texts. So we may find more there. And as Caelan says, just hidden in libraries. One thing that strikes me from that question and what it generated is that there's a whole lot of autobiographies and memoirs that we've lost, which sort of looks like a conspiracy, doesn't it? Somebody buried them at some point. If you've got that turn of mind, that conspiratorial turn of mind, maybe there's a reason they've been buried.
When Hadrian's autobiography as well, because then we have the version of what happened with Antinous, which Cassius Dio says, you know, Hadrian says it was all an accident. So I'd love to see his defense.
How about we ask one from the list that we've got now? We've got one here that, Caelan, you've put your name next to. When we put a stamp on AD 476 as the fall of the Western Empire, I know it's a modern concept. Did the people of living in the West feel like, it's over, the empire fell yesterday or 2 weeks ago? Or was it more gradual or even unnoticeable to them? And this is from Kevin Callahan in Baltimore.
Thanks, Kevin. It's a great question. 476 is the deposition of the boy emperor Romulus Augustulus. And its origin as a turning point is actually comes from Constantinople in the 6th century. It comes from a writer called Marcellinus Comes. So the continuing Roman Empire in Constantinople, the Eastern Empire, had an investment in sort of pinpointing when the West fell, but they continued. Romulus Augustulus was actually a usurper who displaced the legitimate emperor Iulius Nepos, who was recognized by the Eastern Empire. And Iulius Nepos actually survived until 480, and he was in Dalmatia. And Odovica, who became kingly, continued to mint coins for him. But there was something of a nice symmetry in the last Roman emperor being Romulus, the little Augustus, because, of course, we have the founder of Rome and the first emperor. As to whether people noticed what was going on, there are lots of different layers to this question. Of course, the Western Empire had been under significant military pressure in the decades before 476, with the loss of territory. For example, Carthage was captured by the Vandals in 439. Africa was lost. And I think if you were living in those areas, you think about the devastation of warfare on your agriculture and the economy, that definitely has, you know, would affect people's lives. Often we don't think enough about everyday people when talking about the fall of the Western Empire. But at the same time, many of the institutions continued. So, for example, under Odovica and then the Ostrogothic king of Italy, Theodoric, they saw themselves as part of the Roman Empire. They were legitimized by the Eastern Empire, Eastern Emperor in Constantinople, even though they didn't have the title of emperor. You know, there was still a Senate, for example, and they continued to serve. For example, the military under Theodoric was staffed by Ostrogoths as well. So you would have seen a lot of social change, even in Italy itself. So my answer is it's complicated. It's a great question. I mean, this is why it's continued to fascinate people for so long.
So We'll look forward to those episodes of Emperors of Rome when we get to them in, I reckon, about another 6 years, Kaelin,
at the current rate. 2025.
Something along the lines of that. A quick question from Shane Warren. What did Virginia succeed in to win her laurel wreath? Virginia, that was number one in Melbourne ratings yesterday.
That was the ratings today, that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah, that'll do it for you.
and the outfit is actually from what I guess the Romans would have called Byzantium, because this was picked up in Cairo in Egypt a number of years ago. So I'm representing the entire empire. I don't think the empire didn't get out to Australia, but, you know, damn, I know they would have liked to have.
The next question that I'm going to turn to is from Simon Kirby. Who has proven to be the most reliable ancient historian?
I can only think of ones I don't think are reliable at the moment, who are entertaining. I mean, certainly when I went to uni, we were told that Suetonius was barely worth the paper it was written on, which is not what anyone would say these days. But it was compared to tabloid newspapers. And because I went to uni in the UK, that's a pretty low bar.
We're told that Tacitus is the most reliable if you're taking him over Suetonius. We also seem to refer to Tacitus a lot more than, say, Dio, if he's writing at a comparable time.
Yeah, I only have negative answers as well. We could turn the question on its head and think about what reliability means, reliable for what. So Tacitus is a great insight into the workings of monarchical political culture. And also Suetonius. I mean, Andrew Wallace Hadrill, you know, has talked about how Suetonius is a courtier and provides insight into the courts. So Rhiannon, maybe we could get around this.
I think it's where you have to land, because in the absence of other reliable evidence, how do we judge that? We can't really judge it by modern standards. And maybe I'm going to come back to this dinosaur in a way, which is to say that standards of reliability wouldn't have measured up, I think, in the ancient world to what we would regard as reliable, that we might put on a news report. And, you know, they're questionable because we do know we have sources like that famous speech of Claudius, even as I say I'm doubting myself, but it is Claudius, isn't it, that we have the speech itself, and then we have Tacitus's report of it, which is different. So and that is not Tacitus deliberately reinventing that speech. He wouldn't have considered that an abnormal thing to do, is what I'm saying. He wouldn't have considered himself unreliable for doing that. He's creating his version of history, which is one that is more rhetorically sound, I suppose. I mean, he is a great rhetorician.
Mm. It highlights as well, I guess, the importance of things like, you know, physical evidence, what we can find from that period, such as coins or anything else that can, you know, corroborate these sort of accounts or prove them wrong.
Matt, you also mentioned Dio, and I think it's worth emphasising that for the reign of Augustus, it's actually Cassius Dio who provides the longest and best continuous account of what's happening. Obviously, we have Suetonius's Life of Augustus, which is mostly structured thematically. You know, we have Laius Paterculus, we have, you know, the raised gestae, which of course has its own problems, but Cassius Dio survives intact for most of the reign of Augustus. So we've talked in the podcast about the epitomized versions, those little sort of bite-sized chunks that survive. But for the reign of Augustus, we actually have original Dio, and he preserves so many of the key constitutional changes. You know, the awarded title of Augustus in 27 BC, the so-called second settlement of 23 BC. So although we might doubt his perspective, he does have a gender, which is to portray monarchy as a better system of government than the republic, but he provides lots of details that we wouldn't already have. And I think Rhiannon sent an email just before we went on air about someone asking what the best translation of Cassius Dio is, and it is still the Loeb Classical Library for the complete Cassius Dio, which is available online on Lacus Curtius as well. But also for the reign of Augustus, there's also a Penguin edition.
Kaelin, I don't know what you're talking about with the raised gestae, the achievement of the divine Augustus. I believe every word of it implicitly. I think he only told me. Why would he lie to us?
Exactly. You know, why would he lie? I mean, he's an emperor, you know.
There's nothing at stake for him in writing his epitaph.
Right. I do believe his grief at the death of Gaius and Lucius. I can believe it, that.
Yeah, absolutely. but that's just a tiny portion of the whole thing.
Yes.
Okay, Rhiannon, do you have a question that you'd like to throw to or to answer at all?
I want to answer the question about Bath buildings.
This is from Lou Horton in the UK. A question that has bothered me for years is, did women have equal access to the bathhouses with the men? If you weren't rich enough to have your own at home, what did you do? If the bathhouse was where men of all ranks rub shoulders and network for business and pleasure, it would be pretty intimidating place for a woman to get naked, even if they all did look like Titus Pullo. Sorry, that was the rest of her comment. That wasn't my added commentary there, but it is still a valid comment.
Yeah, I think it might be even more intimidating if that were the case. Okay, I'll try and be fairly brief because we want to get lots of questions in. Women did bathe as well, and we have written sources that indicate that they bathed in a separate area. Varro and architecture says you need to keep those, you know, the women and the men's section close together so you can heat, you can save on heating, basically. Marshall writes a rude epigram, as he does so often, saying that effeminate men should go off to the women's section. And we do have bath buildings from the Republican period that seem to have two different sections. So the same rooms repeated, you know, the hot room, the warm room, the cold room. The problem is that if you go to Rome and you visit those bath buildings now, like the Baths of Diocletian or Caracalla, they only seem to have one set of bathing rooms. So what was going on at that period? Was it mixed bathing by then? We think it was probably different times of day. There's an inscription from Roman Portugal that seems to indicate that, that women got the mornings and men get the afternoon and the evening, which I think means they probably got the better part of the day. That was probably the way that it went. They probably did not bathe together. Although there is some indication, just tiny little indications, that some women broke the rules. So there's a quote from Quintilian, the rhetorician, saying that it's an indication of adultery, a woman bathes with a man. So that it did happen, but it was naughty, basically, muddying the waters a little bit there. Good question, because of course, bathing is so central to the Roman world, and you're quite right, networking as well. And women may well have carried out business deals there too. We do know that Roman women owned businesses, and they might have been, you know, doing some political machinations behind the scenes, and that might well have been where they did it, I like to imagine so anyway. But we don't really see it in films and TV shows, do we? It's not the women meeting in the baths, it's always the men. I was thinking about that earlier, and then I thought, actually, I'm quite glad, given the way women are often treated in those Roman adaptations, I don't need to see them in the bath scenes.
I think the bathhouse in Pompeii is split gender from memory, but the men's half is much nicely more decorated.
Both the Forum and the Stabian baths, that's true in Pompeii.
Mm.
Well remembered, Matt. Thank you. Did you just look it up?
No. Not this time. I actually remembered.
Well, there is that great scene from I, Claudius, to come back to this running theme, where Antonia and Julia meet in the baths. They're wearing towels, of course, because, you know, we don't want to break the censorship or anything like that. But Julia says, oh, I never cover up unless I'm with you, Antonia. And Antonia says, you know, oh, that's quite all this nakedness. That's a scene that's stuck in my mind.
Can't tell.
I've watched it too many times. So, it was very tastefully done.
And also completely on brand for me. I knew the answer to this question from reading Asterix comics, so yeah.
Which probably is the most reliable source, Matt. You've answered that question.
As far as I'm concerned, yes. All right, Kaylin, do you have a question that's taken your fancy at all?
Well, I think I should answer another one pre-submitted. There's one about the major public works projects.
So this question that we've got is from Bob Goki in Cambridge, Massachusetts. How did major public work projects get designed, organized, and accomplished in the Roman Empire? For instance, did Rome have a standing department of public works engineering department that did the design for a new aqueduct? Did it issue one grand contract for the work to a private company, or did it manage the job themselves with a lot of subcontractors?
It's a great question. So in the Republic, the censors, who were in charge of morals and status as well as tax assessments, actually auctioned off contracts for a whole range of things, including public works, but also things like supplying the army to corporations known as societies, essentially, in English. And so, you know, they would auction them off to the highest bidder, and then they would be responsible for carrying out the work. Incidentally, one of my favourite contracts is actually the contract for feeding the sacred geese on the Capitoline, who most famously squawked when the Gauls were invading Rome and woke everyone up. So it was very important to keep them well fed. That's a bit of a digression. But also in the Republic, you had generals who'd return from warfare overseas, their booty. Then they would dedicate temples, which was thanksgiving to the gods, also a benefaction from themselves, the Roman people, as well as serving as a form of advertisement for themselves as individuals. In the imperial period, the emperor started to take over a lot more control of resources and administration, though the empire did still outsource many, many administrative or logistical matters to these companies, including tax collection, help with grain supply. Emperors also, you know, took over public building in Rome. So, you know, great constructions such as the Forum of Trajan, the Baths of Caracalla. They were also essential for keeping people employed. So, you know, a large portion of the population of the city of Rome would be labourers who worked from project to project. And there's a great anecdote from Suetonius Vespasian, Life of Vespasian 18. And Suetonius says, to a mechanical engineer who promised to transport some heavy columns to the Capitol at some expense, he gave no mean reward for his invention, but refused to make use of it, saying, you must let me feed my poor commons. So the idea that this sort of labor-saving device would not be a good thing, because he needed to keep the population of Rome fed and employed. We do also know the names of some architects, such as Rabirius, who was supposed to be responsible for the redesign of the palace under Domitian, the palace on the Palatine, and Apollodorus of Damascus, who was an architect under Trajan, who designed the Forum of Trajan and also Trajan's bridge over the Danube. So rather than these big architects, rather than coming from a central imperial department, were actually, I would say, sponsored by the emperors. It was a patronage system that we see in action.
There's an interesting kind of account written by Frontinus. So he was the overseer of the aqueducts, I believe, and he actually wrote a big treatise about it, which you can get in a Lurb edition. And also in regards to Apollodorus of Damascus, there's the running theory that he was the architect responsible for the Pantheon. And there's an account as well where young Hadrian kind of comes up to him and offers some critiques and a few ideas about how Apollodorus should be doing his job. And Apollodorus is very dismissive of the young Hadrian, which kind of leads to his early demise. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I forgot about that.
A dangerous job being an architect in ancient Rome.
Don't dismiss the boss's son so readily. Yes, and Rhiannon, and I remembered that.
Well, only points all the way, Matt.
Rhiannon, isn't there also something about Domitian and the wanting to be able to see behind him with the polished marble panels when he walks around the Palatine?
Absolutely, which I think comes from Dio Cassius, rather than from Suetonius. So, that he was so paranoid that he had these reflective surfaces so that he could see if someone was coming up to stab him in the back. And he was right to be paranoid, really. That's what happened in the end. Didn't help him.
When you and Virginia go and interview him, you'll have to tread very, very carefully.
Indeed, well, yeah.
Architecture's got a long tradition of having, you know, a strong protective quality. It reminds me of the palace in Japan, in Kanazawa, which has the famous Nightingale Floor, which is the home of the emperor, and the floor is made of joists that are put together in such a way that you cannot tread on them without them squeaking. You could hear any ninjas coming in the night.
Very good method, yeah. Domitian should have gone for that. Maybe he survived longer. Okay, Matt, where do you want to go next?
Rhiannon, up to you.
we're getting towards the end. Somebody has asked, favourite piece of Cicero's self-aggrandisement, or was that you, Matt, asking that?
No, that wasn't me. That was that was Julian who asked a question before, which I think is fine. And Julian's actually here. Julian, I will allow you to talk, and you may ask about Cicero yourself.
Thanks so much, Matt. Pleasure to be here tonight. I think just because Cicero is such a famous author and we have so much of his work, there's so many good stories about Saviour of the Republic. I just wondered what your favourite story of his was.
Thanks for the question, Julian. It's not so much a story about him, but the fact that he wrote an epic poem about his own consulship has always delighted me. The idea that he would write this epic, right? Epic poems are usually about heroic activity, often set in mythical time, founders of cities and wars between great nations. But he wrote it about his consulship in 63 BCE, which was a year that he claimed, at least, to have defeated a conspiracy against the Republic. The reason that I like it so much is we don't have all of it, but we have fragments of it. And it's pretty clear that it was terrible. So Cicero, you know, writes brilliant prose, extremely persuasive as a lawyer, and just sparkling accounts and forensic speeches. But his poetry is just, it's really, really long-winded. And in the interest of time, I will not read you even close to what we have of the full, the longer fragment. But I'll let you judge. It starts, and this is a slightly older translation, but I think quite suitable. "See how almighty Jove, inflamed and bright with heavenly fire, fills the spacious world and lights up heaven and earth with wondrous rays of his divine intelligence and mind." And then after about another 20 lines, which leads us on to "this is about the stars," because he's talking about the sky. The stars basically look down on Cicero as he saves Rome from itself. It's sort of a long-winded version of him saying, "Oh, Rome, how lucky you are with me as your consul," which is another one and sort of associated phrase of his. Rome was lucky to be around when he was in charge and that he saved Rome from this terrible conspiracy. That's sort of my favorite piece of Cicero self-mythologizing and sort of tripping up as he does it. If he hadn't written that poem, then maybe he could have just rested his laurels on his prose. The poem was a mistake.
Kaelin, do you have a favourite Cicero?
Again, back to the his consulship. I love when he goes around wearing the breastplate under his toga. I think that's a great example of self-aggrandizement, you know, drawing attention to, you know, the threats to his person.
It does, it does. And I do think that he's very nicely played in HBO Rome, just to bring it back to that, as a sort of, you know, a figure who never quite settles on anything, but wants to bring everyone together, but utterly fails in doing it.
For the last question, we might throw to Tamara Peterson, who asked a good question here in the chat, which I think would be a good one to finish on.
Apologies. She's one of my students.
There you go. Well, this is possibly for an assignment.
My question was, if you could invite four imprison their wives to a dinner party, who would they be and what would you serve?
Four's a biggie. Maybe we do two each or one each.
Four's a lot.
I think I'd like Hadrian there. And it comes back to the psychology. I want to see the dynamic between him and Sabina. Given that we know he's having this long-term relationship with Antinous as well, which maybe was just not an issue for them, but it seems like an issue to us. So I'd be intrigued with that.
Kaelin, who would you like to have dinner with?
I think I have to have Nero at my dinner party, you know, just to see what is going on there, you know. Nero and Poppaea, I think, maybe. Ask him all the questions, you know. Did you really burn down Rome to build your huge new palace? I think he would be great fun.
I'd just like to be invited to one. I'm going to flip the question and say that if I could, you know, materialize magically back there, it would just be, and it wouldn't necessarily be to an emperor's dinner party or a noble man or woman's home dinner party, but just to sit at table. I collect cookbooks, and I've got a fantastic cookbook downstairs, which is ancient Roman cookery. There's not a lot of variation. There's a lot of honey in a lot of dishes, I have to say, and cloves, and I get why. There's, you know, the reasons are self-evident, but just to sit at table with anyone would be fantastic.
I don't think I'd eat any of the food. Little of it's going to be even vegetarian, let alone vegan. I suppose the honey is probably ethically produced at least, and that would improve the flavour of a lot of things, but that fish sauce over everything.
The garum, yeah, that's, yeah. Oh. Now, I recall that there was a butchered giraffe's leg found in Pompeii. I wouldn't mind trying giraffe just to say that I've done it.
Shame on you.
You're probably going to be on a list now.
Look, no, I wouldn't do it now, but if I'm back then and Nero says, hey, Matt, pass a giraffe, might take a little nibble.
Doesn't matter. It's on Twitter now that you ate giraffe and that's it.
Once tried to make Roman food with a group of teenagers at a summer school, which I was teaching at in the UK. And we made these sort of polenta cheese balls, which I got from a Roman cookbook. Oh, my goodness, they were revolting. The kids loved them, but I couldn't stomach them. Cheese and fat and, yeah.
All right, we might wrap it up there, guys. Thank you for all coming along. And if I could give my thanks to Virginia for welcoming us so warmly and being with us tonight. And as always, to Kaylin Davenport and Rhiannon Evans for their knowledge over the past 150 episodes and for as many more as I can annoy them to take part in.
Yeah, I'd like to thank Virginia too. It was terrific. And thank you so much for sticking around and being the one who dressed up and putting us to shame. And I'd like to apologise to all the questions we didn't get to. There were so many good ones. We'll get to some of them in an episode sometime later.
That was myself, along with Rhiannon Evans, Kaylin Davenport and Virginia Trioli. And you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. Please leave a review. They are always very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow us all on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Kaylin is at Dr. C. Davenport, Virginia is at La Trioli, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for the 150th episode of Emperors of Rome. So until CLI, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.